Thank you. You may be seated. We'll have to look at having the missing verse reinserted there. Our hymnal leaves out the third verse. Possibly intentionally, because it's one that some people might have an issue with. In the third verse, it speaks of grief and pain in life, and then refers to them as God's messengers, and says that when she learned, like, living for Christ alone, the pain and suffering, she refers to it as their sweet refrain. So that third verse is kind of the focal point of the whole hymn, but the last verses of chapter 3, right? We're in 1 Corinthians, and we are come to the end of chapter 3 here, and these last verses of chapter 3 are a preliminary conclusion to these two topics that have taken up the early chapters of 1 Corinthians. And those two topics, which you can probably recite together with me now, because we've just been hammering away at them for a couple months, are, first of all, how the Corinthians were jockeying for prestige by taking positions on who the better apostles were, praising one over another, and then priding themselves that they're with it enough to recognize who the better apostles are. And then the second topic was the more important one, right? Kind of behind that was the idea that the Corinthians were looking at their teachers and using all of these criteria because their baseline assumptions were all wrong. Their assessment of what life is about and what makes life good were derived from the world's idea of wisdom and power and success, not from what God says. And he made behind it has just been this idea that the cross first exposes all of those human ideas as utterly worthless, but then if people are willing to let go of those ideas and really relearn the most basic things about life and what makes it good, then the cross reveals this shocking image of what God says life is about. And it's summarized in a crucified Messiah. So again, here we have the preliminary conclusion of those two themes. And I say preliminary because in chapter 4, Paul will continue with this, but he will continue by applying this, right? This kind of concludes the teaching about it, right? And then he will apply it in a very, very direct, very concrete way to their attitudes towards him and towards his work. That will be in chapter 4. He will speak very openly about how he himself lives a life that is very deeply marked by the apparent failure of the cross. And then he uses his life to throw how they do life into real sharp contrast as being utterly crossless. But like I said, that's going to be the next chapter. So this passage divides neatly into two halves, right? The verses 18 through 20 kind of conclude the whole topic of human wisdom versus divine wisdom, with a call that the Corinthians abandon their so-called wisdom in order to begin learning true wisdom. And then in verses 21 through 23, he concludes the topic of boasting in leaders by putting them, their leaders, and the apostles, and God, all in their proper places. So this is 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 18 to the end. Do not deceive yourselves. If any of you thinks he is wise by the standards of this age, he should become a fool so that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness in God's sight, as it is written, he catches the wise in their craftiness. And again, the Lord knows that the thoughts of the wise are futile. So then, no more boasting about men, people. All things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world, or life, or death, or the present, or the future, all are yours. And you are of Christ, and Christ is of God. The word of God for the people of God. So do not deceive yourself. See, serious warning. And it implies that they are, in fact, deceiving themselves. How are they deceiving themselves? Well, by thinking that they're wise. The Corinthians, especially the leaders, saw themselves, and by leaders, you know, these may or may not be people who occupied official roles in the church, right? This is a young enough church that they may have like had elders, probably. But when I speak about leaders, this may be people who didn't even have official roles, but are just the people who naturally kind of step up and speak their mind, and people tend to follow them. So the Corinthians, especially those who were stepping into leadership, saw themselves as mature, as spiritually insightful, discerning people, right? The people who get what's really going on and can explain it to everybody else, and everybody else says, oh, yeah, that makes sense. So they had what it takes to spot the best among all the good enough, right? They thought of themselves as the people who could sort through all the dribble drabble and extract the real kernel of what's of genius. And among all the foolish Christians who can't see past a whole bunch of just a set of rules, they saw themselves as the one who understood things like that participating in idol worship wasn't really a big deal because idols aren't real. People who know 1 Corinthians well will recognize some of these things. These wise Corinthians understood that occasional sexual relations were fine because we're free from the law and all things are permitted. They understood that greed and or what the world might call greed and indulgent living were really just peachy because, hey, God made the stomach for food and the food for the stomach. And having tasted real solid food from better teachers than Paul, they can now see that Paul's teaching is really just milk for babies, and they've outgrown it. So we really don't need to listen to him anymore. And in that wisdom, they were destroying the church that God was building, leading others astray into their errors. So while they were not in danger of losing their salvation, as Paul made the point, they are in danger of making an utter shipwreck of their spiritual lives with eternal consequences. And I don't think you have to think about that for very long before it becomes sobering. You have to think about it a little bit because the specific issues of the Corinthians, such as whether you can eat meat from an animal that has been sacrificed in the temple to an idol before being sold in the market, right? Some of the specific issues may not strike home at us, but they had these devastatingly wrong ideas because they were simply operating from the same mindset as all the other people around them. They were still just functioning on the same operating system from before they were Christians. Right? They had not allowed the gospel to overhaul them to the core, and so they were still operating on default human factory settings. And this is where we are similar. Right? And that's not to imply that you haven't learned anything from the Holy Spirit, because you have. There are like real fundamental things that have been changed in your life. You have learned things from the Holy Spirit. There are things in your life that really do bear the mark of the cross. But how many onion layers are there? Every time you think the Lord has torn that dragon skin away, right, for the Narnia fans, you look down and you expect to see Eustace finally, and you just still see another dragon skin. Whenever we allow the Spirit to search our heart, we will see that there are still issues and situations and questions that we approach and assess and come to conclusions about with a way of thinking that has not yet been gutted out and rebuilt by the Spirit wielding the cross. And we don't always recognize just what they are, because they're part of how we see things. So we don't recognize often how they are. But even if we don't recognize them specifically, we know that there are many places in our lives where we continue to live as mere human beings and make excuses for ourselves. So what do we do if these are things that we don't even recognize? Well, Paul says that anyone who is wise will choose to become a fool in order to become truly wise, right? So here, to become a fool means to renounce human wisdom, to become a fool in the eyes of the world. That's why the NIV puts fool there in quotation marks. To become a fool means to renounce wisdom, to renounce the way that the world understands things, which will make you a fool in their eyes. If the cross demonstrates that no human insight, ability, giftedness, strength, or merit really amounts to anything permanent in the long run, then why do we still buy into a system that is built around these things? To some degree, we do it because we do live in that system. But that concession too often becomes, okay, so I just continue to live my own life in this way. If God has declared them all worthless, then the wise thing is to let go of them all and to decide, like Paul, to know nothing except Christ crucified. That's to become a fool, to know nothing in order to become wise, except Christ crucified. When Paul did this, and when any of us do it, or in as much as we do it, the world says, "What a fool! A nice guy, delightful young lady, but what a mistake. He could have been someone. She could have made a difference. Boy, they could have been really successful." When Paul invites those who think themselves wise to become fools, he's calling on them to abandon the human ways of evaluating things. What makes a situation good? He's calling on them to abandon the human ways of thinking, which God, in the end, will judge to be bankrupt, a judgment that we already see in the cross. But the point is not to be fools. He tells them to become fools in order to become wise. Right? They are to abandon merely human ways of seeing things, not because that's the end goal, but because that's simply a necessary step towards learning what God really values. It's a necessary step to learn what really makes life worth living. He calls on them to abandon the human ways of seeing things so they can relearn at the feet of the Spirit of God what true wisdom is, and then live by it. When Paul said that he resolved to know nothing but Christ crucified, that does not mean that he knew nothing. Okay? And a lot of people take it to mean that, that the only thing he ever has in his head is Christ crucified. But what he means, actually, is that by abandoning all that other stuff that he thought he knew and starting from the one thing of just Christ crucified. God's answer to the world looks like Jesus dying in utter failure and humiliation. And then he allows that to become a lens through which he looks at all the rest of life and relearns everything. Christ crucified isn't the limit of his knowledge. Christ crucified is the teacher of everything. When he came to know Christ crucified, the crucifixion of the Christ became the key to understanding the real meaning behind everything else. It was the lens that allowed him to relearn everything that he thought he knew. The knowledge of Christ crucified is in fact a greater knowledge and a deeper wisdom than all the other ways of knowing and being and doing. In the hands of the Spirit, the cross becomes the lens that allows us to look at all of life and learn what's really going on, what is really of value, what a truly wise person will do in a situation. And then the rest of this first half is just support for that call to become fools. To become fools in the eyes of the world is the only wise thing to do because human wisdom is foolishness in the eyes of God and will be condemned as such in the end. A promise of judgment that shows up again and again throughout the Old Testament, of which Paul gives us the two examples here. He catches the wise in their craftiness, which is from Job, and the Lord knows that the thoughts of the wise are futile, which is from Psalm 94. And anyone who turns away from these human ways of evaluating life will see the Corinthians boasting about leaders for what it is, which is absolute sheer silliness. So then, he says, no more boasting about people. And then what follows is really, really interesting. It's stated very simply, so it's easy to not really think through what Paul is saying here. When Paul says all things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Peter, we need to remember what he's already been saying to them, right? That their way of thinking had led them to trying to establish their identity, trying to establish their worth, trying to justify their value, rooting their prestige in their allegiance or connection to these great men, apostles of God, right? So Paul is turning that whole way of thinking upside down when he says, you can't belong to Apollos, you can't belong to Peter, you can't belong to Paul, because they belong to you, right? What he means is that those men they admire, those men that they look up to, even the apostles themselves, aren't something greater than them. The apostles only exist for their sake. The apostles only exist for your sake. The only reason God created a Paul with all of his education and powers of thought and rhetorical power, the only reason God made a Paul and appeared to him in Damascus was so that he could deliver that wonderful gospel message to you. The apostles were only apostles in order to build up the Corinthians, to build up your lives in Christ. If God had not made it his cosmic priority to transform you into the glorious Christ-like children of God, because that's God's cosmic purpose, right? We exist in order to bear his image in a way that we cannot even fathom. If that was not God's ultimate commitment, there never would have been any apostles. They only exist for you. And in fact, it's actually a lot bigger than that. it's not just the apostles, it's everything. If it were not for God's desire to bless both you and the Corinthians, the universe would never have been created. What is the purpose of life, the universe, and everything? You. The only reason the world, or life, or death even exist, the only reason there is anything at all, is so that there would be a context in which the Corinthians and you can come to know, enjoy, and magnify the glory of God. That's what Paul's saying here when he says, all things are yours. He's telling them, don't you understand? You're trying to justify your existence with some sort of prestige. You're trying to prove you're something. Don't you know that there's nothing higher than you? That all things exist simply for you to come to know God. All things that are now or ever will happen are for you, he says to them and to us. The purpose of all that is or will be is our glorification as the children of God. And the Corinthians are trying to demonstrate their value by connecting themselves with big name teachers, with brands, or with trappings of success. Do you feel better about yourself when you finally get the car you always wanted? Or when you show up to a teacher's meeting wearing just the right outfit and you feel like, wow, now I'm a teacher. Now I have my dream. Now I'm someone in the world. Someone in the world? No, the world is privileged to be the place where you exist. You're trying to get ahead and prove yourself successful by pursuing all these goals and things, but you yourself are infinitely more important than any of those things you pursue. They are all temporary illusions, while you are the reason the universe exists. But he doesn't stop there. Life itself is for our sake. Emphatically doesn't mean that life is for us to do what we want or pursue our own ideas of fulfillment. When Paul says that we are at the top of everything created, he doesn't say we're at the top. Because Paul continues, after saying that all things belong to you, he says, and you are of Christ. And Christ is of God. You really are the purpose or the reason for everything that exists or happens. But you aren't the ultimate reason. Because you, in turn, have a reason or a purpose outside of yourself, which is God's glory through Jesus Christ. And understanding this, that our purpose or reason for being is God through Christ, is critical for understanding what Paul just said about abandoning human ways of thinking in order to learn divine wisdom. Without God's purpose, the glorification of God, as the ultimate goal, letting go of the old wisdom to learn the new wisdom would really be nothing more than just another self-help philosophy, like the, I don't know whose Facebook posts pop up on the pages you look at, but there's just so much out there of just these nuggets of wisdom of how to make life more fulfilling and stuff. And if it weren't for the fact that all of this is in pursuit of God's purpose, then what Paul says here, I almost want to name the person's Facebook page because some of you know them. You know, it would just be another self-help philosophy, right? Exchanging get what you want and you'll be happy for Be content with what you have, and you'll be happy. Both have as their goal, you'll be happy. To pursue your own fulfillment in wise ways, or to think you're following Paul and pursue your own fulfillment in foolish ways, are both completely missing the mark. But Paul connects this new wisdom, this divine way of doing life, with the understanding that the purpose of our existence is for God to have his way. And by doing that, Paul is saying that God's wisdom is not just a new way of doing life. And that's what it's so easy to reduce this whole thing about divine wisdom and human wisdom to. It's so easy to reduce it to, I'm going to pursue the same goals. I want to be happy. I want to be successful in some definition of the word. And I'm not going to do it by fitting in with the world. I'm going to do it by, like, fitting in with the church. I'm going to obey all God's laws. I'm going to do everything right. Everything I heard growing up in the church. And because of that, I'm going to be happy and fulfilled and successful. That's missing the mark of what Paul is saying with all this human divine wisdom stuff. Paul is saying that God's wisdom is not just a new way of doing life, a new way to the same goals, but a whole new goal and direction, a totally different understanding of what the purpose of life is. And that's one of the reasons that Jesus' obedience had to go all the way to the cross. It had to be total, utter, complete, irrevocable, final failure, according to every worldly understanding of success. God's wisdom is a whole new way of doing life because it has in its sights totally different goals. Not success, not pleasure, not fulfillment, but the glory of God. And ironically, because that's why we exist, the glory of God, our rejection of human ideas of success, pleasure, and fulfillment paradoxically prove to be the greatest success, pleasure, and fulfillment. Have you seen through the illusion? You have, because all of us do. It's that disillusionment that we all go through in the process of growing up. And by growing up, I mean childhood and adolescence and young adulthood and middle age and older, right? There's constant disillusion, right? We're constantly seeing through the illusion. But somehow we never see through the illusion all the way to the end. Are the people who have what they really want better off? I mean, I'm glad that I know people. I have people in my life who really can do anything they want. You know, the slightest little whim, even like big ones, they can just do it. Why not? And I'm glad that I know some of them, because it's not that they're horrible, wicked people and they're miserable inside and their life is falling apart. No, they're probably about as happy as I am, but not better. What will all that success prove to be at the end of life when they give an account to God for what they did with the most precious gift of all? Personhood. Independent life. As a thinking, rational, feeling being. As something that's actually more like God than like the animals. Or at least as like God as like the animals. With this incredibly privileged position and calling, what did they do? And as much as you have seen through all the illusions, continue to ask God to teach you what is really of value. Every time you hit that point of disillusionment in whatever it is, Every time your job just doesn't seem to be what you thought it was going to be. Every time your marriage doesn't seem to be like what you thought it was going to be. When raising children turns out to be not what you thought it was going to be. I could go on and on and on and on. When that pair of hip boots that you wanted for 3 years and you finally buy them and they're already going out of style and you are disillusioned, right? Whatever it might be, it is an opportunity to ask God to teach you what does not disillusion. And you know what he's going to show you? The cross. And that cross, and all that it means, will become the lens through which you can look at all of life, your job, your marriage, your kids, your activities, your health, your moods. I could go on and on and on. It will become the lens through which you can look at all of those things of life from a totally different point of view. Let go of those things that we humans know about life and let the Spirit teach you. Because God's desire to glorify himself in you is why you exist. Become a fool in order to become wise. Because all things are yours, and you are God's.